Jim Nance has joined us on Sports Byline. Jim, you joined CBS in 1985, and initially you were working as a studio host for the network's college football and basketball coverage. Now, the dynamics of being in the studio is certainly a lot different than being out on site doing play-by-play. Tell me a little bit about both and your adjustment to each.
You know, it's interesting. It's so many years back now, though. When you mention it, that I first arrived there really as a studio host, it brought to mind right away my concerns that I was going to be, if you will, stereotyped as only a studio host. Not that there's anything wrong with that. But you got to remember, I wanted to call events. I wanted to call the games. And before I got to the network, plotting and trying to all the while figure out the road to get to CBS, I had worked a lot of games. And granted, I was only 26 when I was hired at the network, but even when I was in college, I was calling the Houston High School football game of the week on local radio. I was calling Utah Jazz games with Hot Rod Hungley out in Utah right out of college. I was doing BYU football and basketball play-by-play. All of this, the game experience, was because I thought the game experience would be what would get me to the network one day. Not that, by the way, that I felt entitled to get to the network or that that was automatically going to happen. Remember, I was obsessed. I was just a compulsive believer that, you know, I was going to figure out a way to get there. And then lo and behold, in 1985, I get summoned to New York to audition for a studio role, which I did have studio experience of anchoring the local news in Houston and Salt Lake on the CBS stations in each city. But it was the studio that brought me there. And I felt like once I began my career at the network, of course, you're just trying to prove your worth, that you're good enough to bring back again. But I also wanted to prove to them that I could do games, and thankfully I was able to break through that and have a career that was pretty balanced of both, you know, doing studio and game work.
The one thing that I know about the network level of broadcasting is there's a lot of politics that come into play, and it's awfully hard. And yet I've always felt that because of your demeanor, your nature, your respect for people, that it probably was not as difficult for you. Am I correct in that observation?
Well, the whole political thing, maybe as I get older, I see more of that. I mean, I was so young and naive when I first began. I was just in awe and totally appreciative of everybody I've worked with. I still am, to be honest. It's just it is my nature. It's my father's nature, a very trusting individual of people. He didn't look at people suspiciously. He looked at people and believed in them. So when I began, Pat Summerall was calling most of the games, the big games, the NFL and anchoring our golf. And Brent Musburger was really our studio host, I mean, extraordinary host of the NFL Today and virtually everything from the U.S. Open tennis to the NBA Finals. He was an exceptional host. And I was the understudy on each side, if you will. I was a golf commentator within that first year. Later in my year one, I was a commentator on one of the outer holes for Frank Cherkinian's great, you know, CBS golf team with its proud history. And I was in the studio doing the anchoring when Brent wasn't doing the anchoring. And, you know, I was just Mr. Summerall, Mr. Musburger, and it wasn't, you know, an attempt to, you know, sound like I was trying to ingratiate myself with them or some lame attempt to try to act friendly with them. I just truly was honored to be a friend and a colleague. And I had this problem when I first began on the air because, again, I was 26 years old. And it's just, again, my upbringing, if you will, rooted in North Carolina, where you're raised in a family of yes sir, no sir, that kind of mentality. I couldn't bring myself on the air to call them Brent or Pat. So when they threw it to me, I would say, okay, thank you, Mr. Summerall. And finally, one day, Frank Cherkinian, legendary CBS father of golf television, pulled me aside and said, you know, that doesn't come off right. It comes off a bit unctuous. You've got to quit calling him Mr. Summerall. And for that matter, I'm not Mr. Cherkinian, and I don't want to hear it again. Now get the hell out of my office. Remember, it's Frank, and it's Pat, and it's Brent. And from that point forward, I mean, he kind of straightened me out, and I had to sound like I was on their, not their level professionally, but I was communicating with them on the air as a buddy and a colleague. What a wild feeling that was, you know, to be able to say, okay, Pat, well, over here at 15, this is fuzzy as ever for Birdie, and I'm all the while pinching myself, that I actually was able to call Pat Summerall on the air on a first-name basis.
When you think, Jim, about the moments in the early part of your career and as you've moved along in your career, there have always been crucial, very important moments in games and maybe playoffs and everything. Tell me about some of the moments and how you approached them and how you anticipated them.
Preparation. You know, you can't script how a game's going to play. You don't know how the ball is going to bounce, who's going to hit the key putt, who's going to catch fire in a given day. But you can be prepared for all the background anecdotal information. Bottom line is, though, really, truly, when you're a play-by-play man, you're in the human observation business. It's a reactionary business. There is no one in your headset telling you word for word what to say. Now, they will tell you where they're going with the camera shots and the replays. They'll direct you where the flow of the broadcast might be headed. But in terms of what you're seeing, you know, you have to see it, observe it, and tell people instantly what you see. It's like that old public speaking class in high school, and it was the extemporaneous speaking part of that class that sometimes was a bit hard to get through. Well, that's what this business is. It's live, and it's extemporaneous. And in the background, in your hip pocket, you have all this information that you've memorized, that you prepared for all week long. I enjoy the process. And it doesn't matter if it's a Super Bowl, which I've been a part of 5 Super Bowl broadcasts, or it's a Final Four. I'm broadcast now 28 national championships and Final Fours. I have the background, and now it's just a matter of where does that naturally fall into play. It has to come out organically. You can't jam a story in if it doesn't fit. You have to go with wherever the game's going. And that's the one thing that I've learned, I think, as I've gotten older, more seasoned, is when to drop these stories in and how to get to them, because you need to get to them quickly because the event is still going on. They're going to huddle. They're going to be back to the line of scrimmage in just 5 seconds, and you've got to be finished with that story. Or this guy's about to stand over a putt, and you've got to have this story out in one sentence, and you better sum up a story that you may have read somewhere that was an 8-page feature column, but you need to boil it down to an 8-second remark that makes sense, is in, it's out, it has clarity, it has prose. It's a demand on your language skills. I love it. I thrive on it. I love the feeling when I'm on the air with live television. It's a pressure that you don't get on a tape show, if that makes any sense. But when you're into it, your mind is working at a level that you can't believe. I feel it right now talking to you, Ron, because I'm inspired by, you know, the questions you're asking me are like questions that I don't get very often that are really insightful about our business. And as I'm talking to you right now, I feel in that same kind of flow, and it's a good feeling. Now, just walking around during the week and having dinner with my wife and visiting with friends, I don't feel as sharp. But, you know, when you have that extra gear somehow click in, it's a great feeling.
It's a connection that you're making. You know, I've often asked young people, I said, how many of you want to be broadcasters? And the hands shoot up. I say, how many of you want to be communicators? And I don't know that they know the difference. And that is your strongest suit, Jim, in my mind. You mentioned about being a storyteller earlier, and indeed you are, because you understand that you're not telling people what happened. You're telling them why it happened. And I'd be interested in knowing, because the pace is different with NFL football, it's different with college basketball, it's different with golf, about the adjustments you have to make in your presentation in each.
Well, you definitely have to have a real understanding, like you said, of the rhythm and pacing of each one of those sports. I get a lot of people come up to me and talk about that same thing. Hey, my son wants to go into broadcasting. Man, he knows all the batting averages. He memorizes the box scores. He's got all the stats. You ought to meet him, because I'm telling you, he's got all the numbers in his head. He could do your job. And then I say very respectfully, can he tell a story? Does he listen to the great orators that he's in front of in his life, whether that's a teacher that can really reach him, or a preacher, a priest, or a rabbi, or somebody that he listens to and pays attention to their classical storytelling presentation? And that's what our business is. This is not about numbers. This is about a heartbeat. This is telling people what you see and why something happened. And my preparation, again, I don't naturally click in and say, whoops, this is a golf tournament, slow it down, talk a little more conversationally. It feels to me it's a natural thing. You know, Ron, I go from the Final Four, calling the championship game on Monday night, directly to the Masters, either right after that game that night or early the next morning, and people think, wow, how can you hit that pitch with your voice inside of a dome stadium and 75,000 at the championship game, and then on Thursday during the first round broadcast, you're whispering at the Masters. Come on, that doesn't sound right. Well, what really wouldn't sound right is if I took the same voice that I deliver on Monday night at the championship game and then was in a golf setting screaming and shouting and having my voice again rise to a level where it's a little higher pitch. Well, that wouldn't be natural. All I do is what is in front of me. If the crowd's on its feet and its energy wave has risen to a very high decibel level, I know instinctively I have to cut through that. If I'm at a golf tournament and it's very quiet as Tiger Woods is standing over a putt, well, I'm naturally going to reflect that. You know, if you were in the gallery at a golf tournament, golf gets people, by the way, Ron, because not a lot of people, there are a lot of people, let's just put it that way, who don't understand the sport. They don't understand why we whisper. They don't really, you know, in a way, they don't really appreciate the little nuances of golf. So, you know, they always ask you about the whisper voice, like it's some sort of synthetic energy or synthetic drama you're trying to bring to it. But, you know, if they were, even as a golf novice, as someone who doesn't even like the sport, if they suddenly were handed a ticket to the Masters, they would know instinctively, as they were standing next to the first tee and Phil Mickelson was about to hit his first shot, they would know instinctively, if they turned to their friend, they would not talk at a normal conversation level with their voice. They would know that they would need to drop their voice if they were to talk at all. It's the setting. So it's no different for me as an announcer, as a broadcaster who comes off a high energy intensity level that's off the charts at a championship game on a Monday night and then drops into Augusta a few days later, that just, again, organically, naturally, instinctively, to match the scene that's in front of it. It's not that hard. You don't even have to, like, remind yourself. It's just, it would happen naturally for anyone, I think.
We got about 90 seconds left, and before I let you loose, I know you're involved with Alzheimer's, and it's something very special to you, and I love people that give back even though they may be getting something from sports. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, it's going to be hard in 85 seconds now, but I will tell you this. I have been given so many blessings and gifts in my life that I realized as my dad was losing his battle to Alzheimer's that I needed to write a book about my dad's life. I wanted it to take meaning. And when I wrote Always by My Side, I realized after that there was a huge audience that had been touched by that. In fact, an Alzheimer's community that had been galvanized by that story about a family trying to care for a loved one. And then it was, what are we going to do? What can we do? Look, we've got this blessing of running off and covering the great championships of American sport. You've got this platform. Your dad would want you to do more. So in 2011, our family opened up the Nance National Alzheimer's Center at the Houston Methodist Hospital down at the Texas Medical Center. And it's named for my dad. And it's not one of these things where we throw a charity event, you know, once a year in a fundraiser. We fundraise every day of our lives. We volunteer our time. And I'm not looking for any medals for this, but my wife, Courtney, is fully committed to this effort. Melissa Miller, who runs my office. I mean, we work this like it's a full-time job, and it is. And we have a tremendous group of people behind us. I might mention Nance Friends, N-A-N-T-Z, friends.org, is our website. And thankfully, in a couple years, we've raised millions of dollars. And our goal is easy. A mission statement is easy to proclaim. We want to one day find a treatment and ultimately a cure for Alzheimer's. It affects too many people. Not just the victim, but the families of the victims. Anyone out there who's listening who's had to suffer through this with a loved one knows exactly what I'm talking about. And I want them to know we're doing everything we can on our end to try to find some answers to this as soon as we can.
Jim, I want to thank you very much. You're welcome here as a friend and also as a colleague as well in the profession of broadcasting. Take care, my friend.
Ryan, I couldn't enjoy it more. Thank you so much.
Jim Nance with us. We continue with more of You in Sports Byline.